Welcome to the second entry in Bureau 42's Greatest Science Fiction Film Tournament series of podcasts. I'm your normal host, Blaine Dowler. And this time, we're joined by Bureau 42 anime expert, Alexander Case.
Hello!
So Alex is here because this week we are looking at the Animatrix. And this is something with a number of segments. It's a bit of an anthology. Alex is joining us because, as I said, he is the Bureau 42's anime expert. I've seen just enough anime to know that it's anime and film is comparable to comic books in print, where it's more a medium than a genre. There are a few styles that dominate it, just as superheroes and Archie-style teen comedy dominate the comic book medium. But if you know where to look and what you're looking for, you can find anything.
Exactly. Everything from conventional science fiction to all sorts of wacky comedies to period pieces to melodrama, you name it, it's there.
All right. So for now, we'll start with the pressing question. What is the Animatrix?
Well, the short version is, from what I understand, when the Wachowskis made the Matrix originally, they were very heavily influenced by Japanese animation, in particular for selling the studio executives on the government lobby scene from the beginning, well, middle of the first film. They showed the producers the movie Ghost in the Shell, which we'll be discussing later in this tournament, and use that to show them, kind of sell them on the visual style of the movie and how things were going to be done. And so with the Animatrix, the Wachowskis decided to take advantage of the medium of animation and anime in general to basically expand on the mythology of the Matrix a whole bunch through an anthology film. Now, most anime films aren't anthology movies. They tend to be either completely original works or things which are related to an existing work, and it's usually just one big long narrative. There have been a few anthology films in anime in the past. Probably the most notable one is Robot Carnival, which was an anthology film put together by director Katsuhiro Otomo, who did the film Akira, which, again, we'll be discussing later on in the tournament. So for this, this basically is put together into a bunch of narrative chunks by various different directors, with scripts generally written by the Wachowskis, with a few original pieces, which we'll get to as we go through this one chapter at a time.
Okay. So the first chapter in this series is the final flight of the Osiris. Now this opens up with a scene, I mean, to me, watching this scene, I wish that the timing had come out that the people making the Daredevil movie could watch this first. Because this opening scene is the one that really shows you how to make combat look like foreplay. That's really what this is, and that's something that the infamous or famous playground scene in Daredevil needed for what they were trying to do.
Indeed.
Yeah, I was also fairly impressed with the way they used the CGI to enhance the animations. It was very much in style with a live-action film, but they had more of the distortions around them. It felt somewhat like test footage for the sequels when you really saw the distortions around Neo before he flew. That's something we see around their hands when they're doing that combat in that sequence. And it also has a very active camera. I wasn't at all surprised to see Square USA in the credits, because looking at the skin textures, it kind of reminded me of Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within. Now, they did a better job of animating the lips. One of the big problems I had with The Spirits Within is that when people were talking, it just broke the suspension of disbelief, because it didn't look like flaps of meat and muscle moving around. It looked like a hole of variable size, and it was just appearing and disappearing. And this did a better job of that. So I did like the animation style and the way it worked. What I did find is there wasn't a lot of story. There's a lot of flash, a lot of substance. It basically sets up one relationship, but that's all it has. We don't really get to know anything about these characters except which two are in love. And without that, I found it kind of less than the emotional impact of the finale. So there was some great action and some nice styles, but I found this first one didn't have a whole lot else aside from being a good introduction that was probably the best visual match to the Matrix film up to this point to help bring people in for that.
Yeah, I agree. part of the thing I think with this is, to a certain degree, this installment, more than any other one, is meant to less establish a character and more set up a plot point. Basically, a brief synopsis of the plot of Final Flight of the Osiris is the Osiris is a hovercraft similar to the Nebuchadnezzar from The Matrix. And while fleeing some sentinels, after we get the mentioned foreplay scene with the two characters, we bring this up so I get the captains, the names correct, the captain and so forth. We have, Thaddeus and Jue, basically having a sort of foreplay sparring in a training program. They come out and discover that the ship's being attacked by sentinels. They then flee the sentinels and come across basically the planned machine attack on, Zion, which drives the plot of Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. And they have to get word of that back to Zion so they can prepare a defense. And consequently, because the story of this installment is focused more on establishing the impending threat to Zion and setting up, setting all that up, everything else kind of suffers. In the documentaries on the DVD and Blu-ray, or they talk about this particular film, they mention that the Wachowskis, the script they gave Square USA, only really covered discovering the planned machine attack and making the drop in the Matrix. The flirtation sequence and all that was entirely brand new and something they added. And the Wachowskis really liked it, but they did provide some feedback, but it's primarily original script is just, oh, we need to provide this bit of exposition to set up the next two movies. And indeed, I believe that Final Flight of the Osiris ran as a short in front of another movie. I forget which movie it was. And so it was very much meant to tease the next Matrix movie. And so consequently, like, I'm glad we get the character development for Thaddeus and Jue. It works really well for what we get and how it's basically stuck on, not exactly at the last minute, but it sets up the two people, their two characters, and makes them kind of interesting, but it's, honestly, this could have done with more time. It's with the Matrix, when we meet the crew of the Neb, we get enough time with all of the rest of them that when they die, we care. Here we don't get that. All we get is Thaddeus and Jue, and coming to this knowing, when I saw this the first time, I had already seen, already had it kind of spoiled to me, and even the title kind of spoils, that all of these characters are going to die. And so it makes it a little more difficult to get attached to the characters and have any sense of loss when they fight it. It's being mentioned about Final Fantasy Spirits Within, with this and Square, USA's animation work on that, is this was actually kind of done after Square USA had finished Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, but before it hit theaters. Though it hit theaters after Spirits Within came out. And it's kind of unfortunate that things happened in that order, because I think that, rather in terms of production order, because I think that if Spirits Within, if they'd done this first and done this as a test run and taking what they learned from this and doing the more advanced textures and so, for skin and making the mouths look good when characters talk and that sort of thing and applied that to the Spirit Within, I think that could have been a much better film. As it is, this is basically the last film to, or last cinematic anything to be made by Square USA Pictures. Final Fantasy, The Spirit Within was a spectacular bomb. Like, it was so bad that it didn't just bring down the Square Films division, it also brought down Square as a company to the point where it had to be bought out by Enix, their biggest competitor, which is why it's now Square Enix. Whenever you buy a Final Fantasy game or a Dragon Quest game or what have you. In fact, even the last movie made on the Square based on a Square property, Final Fantasy VII Advent Children, was, I believe, done by another company. So, on the one hand, for Square USA's last cinematic gasp, this is incredibly good. It still has real flaws, but the action's well put together. The animation is absolutely gorgeous. This is some of the best CGI animation, for realistic characters that I've seen. It's best, definitely better than some of the stuff I've seen with, like, Polar Express and that sort of stuff. But.
Agreed. I was not a fan of Polar Express, especially the quality animation.
Yeah. There's a lot of really good animation work here. And it's just so unfortunate that this is the last thing that Square USA put out. Other than that, the main thing I like is I do like that with these sparring rotation thing, it does make for a nice callback to the training program sequence from the first The Matrix movie. It also kind of puts us in, brings us into the film in a fashion that sets us up in the world of The Matrix with any more than just the scrolling scrolling text credits works out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the 4-year delay between the release of The Matrix and the release of The Animatrix, just the visual style and the callbacks, this was the right short to start it off with, even if it, from a story perspective, it probably should have been the short to end with, because that's the one that leads into the second film.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of reacclimating the audience to the world of The Matrix, in a very short span of time, this does the job very well. Just as you said, there's the callbacks in terms of using the same training program where Morpheus and Neo fought. And then showing the Sentinels, showing the Osiris with the same ship, doing the similar drops as she's going through, it is very reminiscent, point by point and step by step, of that first film.
One other little thing that stuck out, that just clicked in my mind at the moment, is this does establish, aside from the impending threats to Zion for the next two movies, it also establishes one little thing that I had noticed before, which is in the original The Matrix, the Neb has one weapon, the EMP, and that's it. Whereas the Osiris has the turrets. They aren't particularly effective against a large attack by Sentinels, but they do have something else, which is a nice touch and gives the impression that in the years since the last Matrix movie, Zion has gotten some new technological developments and realized that, hey, maybe we need something else than just an EMP, particularly to fend people off until we can get people out of the Matrix, for example, and get them an exit.
Mm-hmm. Now, if they'd only animated the bullets as they were tracing through. One thing I did find is they were following it more as wake than as actual bullets. So they were following curved paths, which, I don't know, maybe this is the far future. Maybe they found the technology where the bullets do follow curved paths and they're homing bullets, but it still felt a little bit wrong to me because they look more like traditional guns and traditional turrets.
Yeah. So that covers everything for Fight of the Osiris. Let's go next to the Second Renaissance, Parts 1 and 2. We're going to talk about these together because they're basically the same thing, the same work.
They are. And this one I found a lot more interesting from a technological perspective and the way it was put together. It does have a mix of 2D and 3D animation, which we've been seeing more and more of, particularly since Beauty and the Beast, at least in North America. They've got some odd inking choices. At the original party scene, most of the characters that are traditionally animated are inked with black lines, but I noticed a few of the very drunk people are inked with white and bordered in white, which was a nice choice. It set up the different moods, and I was expecting black and white and shades of gray for the characters on the way through, but unfortunately from that point on, everything was black, which made me wonder if that was test footage and they decided to not do it for reasons of time or budget or whatever.
Possible.
I also found that they're to me, it felt like there was a lot of influence from the early Fleischer animations from the 20s and the 30s. I don't know if you've seen a lot of them, say the early Betty Boops and the early Popeye cartoons. One of the things that Richard Fleischer liked to do was build physical contraptions and put them in there. So there's the mix of the live action and the traditionally animated, and also do a lot that was synchronized to music. Disney produced their Silly Symphonies in direct competition with Fleischer, who'd actually gotten there first. And when we're seeing this, there's a lot of moments early on. It's a very expositional short. There's a lot of moments where the characters are moving right in time with the beats to the music. And we've got that mix of CGI and the traditionally animated, and the CGI felt like a lot of the contraptions that the Fleischers were using. So to me, the similarities in the feel were so close. To me, it seemed like a deliberate callback rather than something that was just happening by accident.
I agree. I think part of it also is, I was listening to the soundtrack to The Matrix, rather, the music from The Matrix CD earlier, which has the tracks like Club to Death, Curamino Mix by Rob D, and the racetracks by Prodigy and Marilyn Manson. And it kind of hit me when I was listening to this and other stuff I've learned, that a lot of the techno and electronica and industrial tracks that were used in the movie were actually pieces that had been recorded earlier. Club to Death, Curamino Mix in particular was a electronica piece that basically kind of languished in relative obscurity, because it's not exactly something you can really dance to, until the Wachowskis kind of found it and resurrected it for the film and its soundtrack. To the point that, like at classical music stations, the classical piece of music that's sampled in that got more radio play on those stations. It's like variations on a theme, I forget what it's a variations on a particular theme track. And that's got more radio play since then. And I suspect that when, director Mahiro Maeda was animating this, and storyboarding this, it's entirely possible that he'd picked out some particular tracks by Prodigy or whatever, and was listening to those while he was animating it and trying to incorporate those rhythms into the animation, which is a distinct advantage for when you're using catalog music like this, is it lets you work the music into the whatever you're putting together, whether it's animation or live action, in a more organic fashion.
It does, and that's one of the advantages animation has over live action, is that it's so much easier to choreograph when you choose to do that, and you get a very synchronous result. Which helps, because without something like that that compels and moves it forward, this is very expositional. Just the basic plot is it's as though somebody has accessed the Scion mainframe and is asking for the history of the rise of the machines and what led to the war. So we get some nice touches. We get some callbacks to the Tiananmen Square incidents from the late 80s. We see a sequence where there appears to be a young woman being assaulted on the street. And as part of the assault and the violence against her, that's when we learn she's actually a robot. And as a member of the audience, that seemed a little bit jarring, because there's a certain level of sympathy that you have for a human more so than a machine. And it plays into that before you find out what's really going on.
And this leads to actually suspicion I have with this, which I didn't click with me the first time I saw this. When I first saw it, I was like in high school, and again, Matrix Reloaded hadn't come out yet. This collection hit DVD about a few months before Reloaded hit theaters. And I saw this then. I thought I'd just quickly go run over the plot. Second Renaissance is, in short, the mythology and backstory of the Matrix and how everything came to pass. How the machines came to rise up against humanity and why, how the sky was scorched. It basically lays out everything up until now. And the first half is basically before the war, and the second half is the war, is the machine war. Things get started where a robot butler, a robot servant, basically kills its master, after the master is going to have the robot deactivated. And it argues self-defense in court. And this leads to a massive amount of anti-robot hate crime, decision by governments to have the robots exterminated. The robots start their own country called 01 in North Africa towards the vicinity of the Fertile Crescent. And the human governments decide to take it out after 01 becomes more economically prosperous than all of the human-run nations combined, leading to the war, and which we all know ends very, very badly. Now I bring this up as far as the, not having seen this before, the seeing Matrix Reloaded and having a different response now after having seen the Matrix Reloaded, because having rewatching it now with the knowledge of what we learn in movies 2 and 3, I get the impression that maybe this is written by the machines. Because the film is, long story short, the humans before the war and during the war are kind of holding the jerk-ass ball, for lack of a better term. It's basically, in order for the plot to continue and for the war to happen, humans have to be more cruel to the machines than they have ever been in the history of humanity to other humans. And the film, and so we have a massive number of hate crimes, like mass, it's almost like genocide on a scale above and beyond anything humans have ever done to machines. If, would be mechanocide be the right verb?
I don't know. I don't think one exists because we haven't had to deal with eliminating large numbers of intelligent machines yet.
And the scene has massive callbacks, not just to Tiananmen Square, but to the, there's one bit which is a callback to the murder of a captured Viet Cong soldier during the Tet Offensive. A couple other bits there. And well, this is a very, very heavy, emotionally heavy thing. These two installments. We have the robots getting piled into basically mass aquatic graves with bulldozers while human soldiers fire machine guns into them to make sure they're still dead. It's rough. It's emotionally rough. When I first watched this, I remember I had trouble sleeping after watching Second Renaissance. It wasn't like exactly nightmares, but it was, it kept me up at night for a bit.
It should have. I had a hard time getting into it just because watching this, and granted, it's been a few years since I've seen the sequels. I have seen the original Matrix many times and know it pretty well. I have seen the sequels once each on opening night, which, well, that's a story for another podcast, but that tells you where that one's going. One of the things I found here was that the entire setup just felt wrong to me and it felt inconsistent with the universe. This felt like the backstory that the Wachowskis had developed, but that they hadn't intended to release and only put it out because the Animatrix project came along and they needed content. The whole thing is an interface with what seems to be a rudimentary artificial intelligence in the mainframe of Zion. Now, given the world of the Matrix, right then and there, to me, that doesn't make sense. There's also, when Morpheus is talking to Neo and explaining the history, saying, well, we don't know who fired the first shot, but we know who scorched the sky. And now Zion's computers have a complete detailed history, including who fired the first shot. I mean, to me, rather than have the Zion mainframe as the framing story, they should have just had it as standalone. Because this, to me, felt like part of the writer's Bible. And as soon as they framed it in Zion, I was sitting there going, whoa, and just thrown off by the continuity questions. So it is still generally one of the more effective shorts in here, but I couldn't get completely into it just because those little nagging details threw me off. You can tell that it is still the Wachowskis behind it. It's got a lot of the biblical references that were showing up in the original Matrix. And like the other ones that they wrote, it is very similar in feel to The Matrix, but yeah, there's just a couple little things like that that nagged me enough that I couldn't just completely relax and get into it.
It was kind of a bit different for me because I recognize the tunnels. Even the first time, I kind of recognized, wait a minute, they shouldn't know this. But once we got into some of the more intense portions of the film, that kind of got knocked out by the psychological drubbing that the film was trying to give me. I've seen people in MMA matches that worked over less than my brain in that. In particular, and like the final act, which is the war, is particularly, it is truly biblical. It is like, it is apocalyptic in the biblical sense. Apocalyptic and Armageddon in the biblical sense. In fact, they don't explicitly say it was on the plains of Armageddon, but for all I know, that's actually what the Wachowskis had in mind. That the final battle would actually be fought there. And it's, I can't find the words to describe how rough that is. Like, there's bits where, we have the machines take prisoners, and they're not gentle in how they take prisoners. They have one where a guy is strapped into one of the sort of mechs that humans have, which we see a rougher version of them, more primitive version of them in Matrix 3. And the way the pilot is strapped into this, they have the arms strapped into the arms and the legs strapped into the legs. It's kind of like power loaders in Aliens. And the robot, one of the machines, takes off the chest piece and pulls the human out of the mech suit and doesn't exactly try to properly remove him from his restraints first. Let's leave it at that. It's kind of nightmare fuel. It's very well executed nightmare fuel, but it's nightmare fuel. The voice acting here helps a lot in a lot of this. In fact, it's worth mentioning that the English cast for this and many of the other shorts here includes Dwight Schultz, who Star Trek fans may remember as the voice of the actor who played Reginald Barclay. And if you couldn't look past him as Barclay before, you may be able to look past him after hearing some of his work in this and the numerous characters he plays, many of whom are varying degrees of, well, just a broad variety of characters. It really shows his depth as a voice actor. And other than that, it is interesting that, aside from basically two characters, basically the robot butler who does the murder at the beginning and, any sentinels appear later, a lot of the robot designs here were done by Mahiro Maeda, who'd done a lot of mechanical design work in his background. He doesn't always do a lot of this stuff himself. They mentioned this in the documentary features, but for this, he felt it was important enough that he do a lot of this himself. Among his previous work is he actually worked on the first thing that I reviewed for Bureau 42 as far as anime. He did mechanical design on Gunbuster, among other works. Probably his biggest thing he ever directed was Blue Submarine Number 6, which I probably should review at some point in the future. He's even been involved on the recent Evangelion movies, which makes sense, and also a very similar tone to these. He also did direction on the basically anime adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo, Genkutsuo. I'm hopefully not mangling that too much. And he has a really good visual stylistic flair and works for the various, for handling the presentation of the story as sort of edited together footage, with exceptions of a few bits, which are clear eyewitness kind of stuff. And actually, you can see a little bit of the stylistic elements that he used in Gankutsuo for his depiction for how he depicts the interface of the Zion mainframe. But yeah, this is intense. And actually, I'd say that this is the point in the work where if you were convinced that if you're still thinking, oh, animation is for kids, even after the warning at the start of the movie that says, this is based on an R-rated movie, you probably shouldn't be having your kids watch this. This is the point where you probably, if you're watching this with your kids, you should be having your kids leave the room. If I was watching this as like 10 or 12, I really would have gotten actual nightmares. Or younger. So next one is something lighter, relatively speaking, Kid's Story, which is directed by Shinichiro Watanabe, who, among other things, created the television series Cowboy Bebop and directed that in the movie. He also did the Macross 7 OVA and the Samurai Champloo anime. He's actually still active. He's one of the more active people in terms of direction. Recently doing the anime Kids on the Slope, which is a completely non-action fair about people getting interested in jazz. So he has a very interesting style, and this is probably one of the most different in terms of animation style than everything else that's been everything else in the movie.
It is, and in animation in general, the style here is very distinct, and it wasn't something I was really prepared for. I noticed a lot of times, you know, typically it's color inside the lines, and you've got the sharp lines to define it. This looks, it almost has something of a charcoal feel, where you see the rough sketch pencils outlining things. The colors frequently go outside the lines, and there's varying levels of detail according to what the main character is going through. This is a case of a young child, probably about high school age, somewhat like Neo. He recognizes that he's not fitting in this world. There's something out there. And you get some highly detailed on-model art when he's at his computer, and the further he gets from that computer, the more off-model and more surrealistic it becomes, which I thought was a nice thematic touch, bringing things together. We get a lot of that, especially when he's in the classroom and they're trying to contact him and his phone's ringing even though it's supposed to be off. And he ends up running from the agents and finding a way out of the Matrix, setting things up on his own. We do get a lot of that feel, and it's a blend. The individual look is great. So frame by frame and panel by panel, it looks very good, but one of the things I didn't particularly care for in the way it was put together is that it seems to have a low framing rate. So even though the film is going at 12 frames a second, even though the film is going at 24 frames a second, at times it feels like they're more animating only 12 frames for some of the characters. So some of the motion I found it got a little bit choppy, especially early on when he's moving more so than the action sequences. The action sequences, they lost detail, but had a higher frame rate in terms of the cells being produced.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting where I wouldn't say this film uses rotoscoping, but it has semi-rotoscoping. All of the classroom locations were actually found through location scouting at an actual high school in San Francisco where they were doing some production work on the Matrix movie, rather Reloaded and Revolutions. And the director, Shinichiro Watanabe, basically sat down and filmed the actor, Clayton Watson, going through some of the actions as far as for the dialogue sequences, not so much the actual action sequences like the skateboarding or some of the wall climbing stuff, to give references for how the character moves, how the character acts, and that sort of thing. I want to say Clayton Watson is the same person because, the kid in this is the kid who appears in Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions, who basically is he is. He is the kid in Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. This basically introduces him in those movies, for those movies. And they got the same actor to do it. I want to double check that. And so it's makes things consistent with his character there. I do agree that the motion kind of threw me out a little bit for some of the characters where their frame rate dropped, but it kind of worked, particularly since the climax kind of sets up that supposedly the kid kind of logs himself out of the Matrix. It's not supposed to be clear how it works, but he manages to transcend the Matrix on his own.
I think they called it self-actualization and were surprised that it was possible.
Yeah.
Even though they basically said that's what Neo did in the Matrix the first time, is he set himself free.
Yeah, and so it kind of works as far as like with things going out of focus and motion becoming more jerky relating to as the kid is becoming less and less part of the Matrix and forcing his way out, how it relates to that. It works surprisingly. I think it kind of worked for me for a stylistic decision. And particularly since the coda for the film, which has the presumed funeral for the kid, the line animation is gone, pretty much. Mm-hmm. It's more conventional animation. And it clicks with that for me in terms of how the kid is perceiving the Matrix, now he's forcing his way out.
Yeah, it was a very thematic choice, and it really ties the animation style. Again, this short could not be done this way in live action. Just the separation between the realities is fine. And when you're at that funeral, well, the attendees, they think this is normal. They think this is real. So they get spot on model animation. Whereas, as you're saying, the kid, the closer he gets to pulling himself out, the less real his world that he's in becomes.
Okay, so next work is Program. This one is by a director who's probably the biggest name talent on here, bigger than Shinichiro Watanabe, and that's Yoshiaki Kawajiri. According to the documentary stuff, the Wachowskis requested him by name. Kawajiri is the director of Ninja Scroll, among many of his other works. Ninja Scroll is probably the work that gave him recognition in the West, and is kind of one of like, the big three anime films. When people discuss anime movies and they're not part of fandom, is they talk Ghost in the Shell, they talk Akira, and they talk Ninja Scroll. And this is probably, action-wise, probably one of the more mundane works of the whole piece.
It is. I did find, even the animation style, there's a lot of detail in the line work. We get some CGI that puts things together. In some cases, there's almost a Hanna-Barbera feel where they've got looped animation to show characters running instead of reanimating every frame. There was a very stark use of color. The color palette is very tightly controlled. Through much of it, when they're in this training program, it's black and white characters with splashes of red. And it sets it up, and you can see thematically and emotionally where the lead female character is reflected in the amount of red that's seen on panel. Which is, again, something that's largely unique to animation. You can use color filtering and things like that. Thinking particularly of Steven Soderbergh's Traffic is probably the most extreme example of using color filtering. But even then, it washes the color, whereas this feels more like an accent, and it's punching rather than washed.
Yeah. In fact, the backgrounds in particular reminded me of traditional Japanese art. I actually did some quick research of trying to see what artists it reminded me of the most. And there's some stuff from in Japan's Muromachi period, which really, really reminds me of this, with kind of the heavy contrast, the not just like a white background, but like a kind of shades of gray to beige, which really kind of stuck out. And also, it stylistically fits because we're in the program, we're in a virtual space, and so in an artificial space, and because of that, things take a stylistic shift towards the artificial. Narrative-wise, the story is interesting. It's kind of interesting. It's not deep, but there's a few little mythology things that stuck out in my mind. The premise of this is this woman, Sis, is in a training program when one of what we presume is her crew members, Duo, approaches her and asks to spar. Duo says, in the course of sparring, reveals that he's basically done a cypher-styled deal with the devil, and he's going to sell the crew to be put back into the Matrix. And he asks Sis if she wants in, and she fights him off and eventually defeats him. And it's later revealed to be, in fact, a training program. And I thought this was kind of interesting, because it's kind of an interesting way of maybe Zion sort of learning from what happened with the Neb in Matrix 1, because it meant to be sort of like it's not just a training program, but a test of, I don't know, mental stability or something like that. Kind of gives the implication that Zion learned from Cypher's betrayal and is now kind of testing people for loyalty, for lack of a better term, before sending them out where they could theoretically get back into the Matrix.
Mm-hmm. Which to me makes me wonder, what happens to the candidates who fail this test?
Yeah, that is kind of a awkward question. I'd hope that Zion's basic response is, okay, we send the ship back and you just kind of get to hang out in Zion and work there for a while. You're not fit for remote access duty, basically.
Yeah, hopefully that's isolation, but with this, you never know, because one thing that we have seen in the Matrix world right from the start, especially when they're in the Matrix, is that there are innocent lives that fall as collateral damage, right? Innocent people get taken over as agents while they go down.
Yep.
And you can't hesitate. So this isn't the same. This is not someone who can become an agent. So, as you're saying, the more humane option is to put them in isolation, but I don't think we know enough of the technology of the world to know exactly how isolated that is.
That's true.
It's a question that's not explored on screen, but it gives fodder for fans to talk about and debate.
Yeah. Other thing to pick or note is currently a lot of Japanese animation, they do more of the CG combined with 2D animation, which is like what we saw in the second Renaissance. Particularly since a lot more of the people who are interested in mechanical design, who does in turn design the vehicles and that sort of thing, are getting into 3D design more than just sketching it out in 2D like what you'd have back in the day with Star Blazers or Gundam or Robotech or what have you. Whereas here, Kawajiri is very much into straight up 2D animation, ideally even all done by hand. And it kind of shows here, and particularly with the reuse with the looped animation for running and that sort of thing. And that'll actually come up in the next work, World Record, which is directed by Takeshi Koike, who's done a work which I've reviewed previously for the Bureau. Redline, which is basically which is the most recent work that I know of that has been just done is for 2D animation, 2D hand-drawn animation for a feature-length work. And narratively is done as a love letter to 2D hand-drawn animation.
It is, and it's very stylized animation. Again, we get some color palette extremes, where the Lost One is shades of gray and red. This time we get more earth tones, we can have yellows and browns. But again, there's a very tightly controlled color palette here. Basic idea is, there's a guy pushing himself for a world record and sprinting, pushing himself hard enough that his trainer's saying, back off, forget it, I want no part of this, you're going to destroy yourself. And it leads to what seems to be another way to free yourself from the Matrix. Even though, again, that surprised the many kids story.
Yeah, though, unfortunately, it doesn't quite work for this character, where he doesn't quite free himself enough, or get out enough. He ends up running into an artificial barrier on the other side, which gets him knocked back in.
Yeah, and it is a nice touch. There are a few questions that are raised in terms of the continuities. And we hear the agent say that, well, they've edited his memories, he'll have no recollection of this. And to me that says, well, if they can edit memories, how does anyone get out and how do they have lingering doubts over the long term? Maybe it does set aside, or maybe it does set up the fact that they mentioned in the first film, and not everyone is ready to be extracted, and usually it has to be done when you're very young. And I believe they even said Neo might have been the oldest one they'd ever extracted.
I think so, too.
I did like the fact that this vignette has a complete story, unlike some of the earlier ones, especially that Final Flight of the Osiris, there's not a complete story there. As you say, it's more, here's a piece of the puzzle that we need to fit right here. But this one, we do have a complete story with characters that are just, it happens to be in the Matrix world. There is that the climactic sequence where he faces down with the agents as he almost breaks loose. To me, with all the stress he was under, the fact that he wasn't trying to get out of the Matrix, I don't know how much memory editing they would need to get him to sit back in. Maybe he's just willing to accept it where others won't, and that's why they can edit his memories. Because this is not a guy who wants to get out. This is a guy who just basically stumbled on a way to get out when he was pushing himself for other goals. And the goals he was pushing for really have no meaning outside the Matrix. So this is a guy who really is home inside.
Agreed. One other interesting bit about this is I mentioned Takeshi Kuiki's later work, but this is the first thing he ever directed. He'd done key animation work and some animation direction work for various TV shows and movies and that sort of stuff in the past. But this is the first time where he basically got to sit down in the big chair and have control of everything. Visual design, how it'd be done. The only thing he didn't do on his own is the story. And actually, this is another one where the story was written by, it was not written by the Wachowskis. It was written by Kawajiri. It was written by Yoshiaki Kawajiri. And it also makes things pretty interesting because it's not explicitly part of the Wachowskis' vision of the Matrix. It's somebody else kind of interpreting it, their work. But it still works incredibly well. It's great. I'd say it's probably one of the stronger works in the piece, overall. But I wouldn't say the strongest. The strongest one is actually the one that comes next, which is Beyond. Which kind of again which is also not written by the Wachowskis, but expands on some stuff from the Matrix. Basically, it kind of perfectly expands on the stuff from the first movie with the deja vu. And how things which, that when the machines change something in the Matrix, or that there can be glitches in the Matrix. And basically this leads to a haunt story being about a sort of semi-haunted house, which is in fact one big massive glitch in the Matrix. Rendering errors and file glitches and all. And a bunch of people in Japan who discover this, a bunch of kids and a young adult, and who play around in there, until basically the agents come and take their playground away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. There was also very interesting choice. It's something I haven't seen before. This also has a mix of the 2D and 3D rendering that we've had in a lot of the other ones. The 2D elements here are the characters. But when they did the 3D environments, a lot of them look CGI. They've got that distinct CGI texture. In this world, the 3D backgrounds are really rendered with like oil painting textures. So it looked like the characters were walking around inside an oil painting, especially when they were inside the haunted house itself. And that's something I found worked. I often have issues with 2D and 3D combinations because you can see the line where this was done by hand, this was not. They are very different styles. But the way they rendered it here, if you were to look just one frame at a time, you wouldn't know that the backgrounds were 3D. That only comes out in the way the camera moves and you see things scaling as it's panning around and tilting through this haunted house. That's where we know, oh, this is a 3D environment. So it was a very nice touch. And as you mentioned, it's a haunted house. The young adult is coming in here looking for her lost cat after checking a bedside clock that has four hands. I don't know if I haven't seen one like that before. One's a distinct color. Maybe it's an alarm or something. But it is nice, and it does set things up. Unfortunately, when you have an anthology this size set in the Matrix world, it starts to come into something of a trap. When you get yet another thing that exposes the fact that we're in the Matrix, it begs the question, why don't more people know about it? So we've had a few shorts in a row where people are stumbling on either ways out of the Matrix or otherwise evidence that the Matrix exists. And here they don't mention memory wipes. It's just, oh, this is the haunted house, and these kids are playing in it for quite a long time. They know what to do. Now, for the young kids, it looks like they've been here before. They've developed entire games with rules about, you know, jumping off the second story and stopping before you hit the ground. As I said, it was one of the stronger ones. I personally didn't find it to be the strongest entry. We're actually still coming to that one, in my opinion. But it was very enjoyable.
I particularly kind of liked, as far as like the breaking the illusion of the Matrix for the kids, to a certain degree, I think it kind of works because everyone here is a younger person, particularly kids. Partially because adults can dismiss what the kids are talking about with through imagination. Oh, the kids these days and their vivid imaginations and that sort of things. But also in terms of, by putting it sort of as, oh, that's the haunted house, it coaches the stuff that goes on in there in the context of urban legends and that sort of thing, which is a little bit actually what we see later in Matrix Reloaded, where we talk about where the Merovingian talks about twins as being, and some of his other minions as, oh, these are failed attempts at agent programs. These are the rejects. The rejects became vampires. The rejects became werewolves and that sort of thing. Or what we know of in popular culture and mythology as werewolves and that sort of stuff. It's how the mind explains it without revealing, oh, you're actually in the Matrix.
The human mind has an uncanny knack for rejecting things it doesn't want to accept. That's been used before. Just go back to Buffy. The entire town of Sunnydale is just like, yeah, that didn't happen, and moves on.
Yep. One thing that really helped for this is the director of the piece, Koji Morimoto. This comes up in the special features and the making of featurettes. Is he incredibly, incredibly picky about everything visual in this, in everything he does. If there's one small thing that's not perfect that someone points out, he scraps it and starts from the beginning. And this level of attention to detail on this, and that eye for precision and perfection, really shows here for how well everything just works perfectly. I would say that though the next one has a very good next piece, Detective Story, has a very good visual style. I think this one's better, but and more visually better, but I do like Detective Story a lot as well.
It is. This is the one that I was referring to when I said that the one that I felt the strongest piece was still coming. I'm a big film noir fan, and they nailed it. This feels like the classic gumshoes of the radio from the 1930s and into the 40s and a little bit of the 50s, the movies from the late 30s, the 40s, the 50s. So this even starts off with references to Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe. And it comes a lot in that style, where a private detective has been paid an insane amount of money to track down the hacker named Trinity. And he is going through and tracking her down. Of course, they do have Carrie Ann Moss coming back to reprise her voice, just as they do with Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne in The Kid's Story. You know, when you've got a character that you've seen in the movie, they use the same voice actor that you've got in the movies, just to help maintain that consistency. And I found it worked very well. We've got basically black and white styles with, again, short highlights of color, such as the lighter flame and things like that. Trinity gets set up as the femme fatale as he's tracking her down, and they both realize he's been manipulated and blinded by that massive quantity of money. Because they did track down a private investigator who's almost broke. He says both his fridge and his bank account are empty, and that's part of the problem. He is not the first private investigator to go this route, and it does establish part of the threat here. So he ends up, well, classic style, he doesn't necessarily have a happy ending here. Because he is very much plugged into the Matrix, so when he tracks Trinity down, there's no reason that the agents can't become the detective instead. So I just thought it was a nice touch, and it's one of the few that really explores one of the characters we've seen in the Matrix films up to this point, and it helped tie it in that way for me.
Yeah, this is another one directed by Shinichiro Watanabe. He's like the only person here who's directed two works, or two separate works, as opposed to one work divided in half, like Second Renaissance. And this one is another one that where it's, this piece isn't written by the Wachowskis. This is written by Watanabe. And it shows, having seen Cowboy Bebop coming into this, all the television series and the movie, is Watanabe channels a lot of the kind of sort of semi-noir that he used in Cowboy Bebop into this, with the private detective main character, the use of, not just the use of narrative elements from noir, but the use of color. The music is also very different. This isn't we're not going to be sticking a Prodigy track in here. We're not going to be sticking Juno Reactor. It's going to be, it's all jazz. In fact, if it weren't for the fact that that because this is a Matrix project, we have Don Davis doing the music, I would be surprised if Watanabe would have brought in longtime collaborator Yoko Kanno in here to do the music, because she has a very, very strong eye for jazz and ear for jazz and how to use those elements to make the music complement the narrative very strongly. The technological design here is kind of interesting in that the computer in the main character Ash's office is much more anachronistic than basically every other computer that's depicted in the Matrix. Everyone else's computer is basically like, it's a terminal, like a normal terminal, you're running a command prompt kind of thing. Whereas the screens on Ash's computers are kind of like a weird flat screen where it's made to look like a projected on a film screen, and his keyboard looks like a typewriter. And all sorts of stuff. And it's a few small bits which kind of bumped me out of it a little bit, because it stylistically broke with everything else.
It was definitely trying to keep the 30 and 40 somewhere feel, where most of them did have that typewriter on their desk.
Yeah. But narrative-wise, this was great. This is definitely one of the other ones where, like, this one, Beyond and World Record are the ones which really tell the most cohesive beginning, middle, end story.
Yeah, agreed.
And this one tells it very well. There's a slight bit of doubt, sort of ish at the end, about whether Ash dies, because theoretically it's entirely possible that he could survive and the agents can mess with this, could adjust his mind just as they did with the guy in World Record. But there's still kind of that opening there for, no, he doesn't make it, and he would have been one that, like, Trinity kind of mentions that she figured he might have actually been able to make it out if she'd gotten able to get him out, and this guy could have taken being extracted from the Matrix, which is a nice little touch.
It is, yeah, where she says, for whatever it's worth, I think you could handle the truth. It was a nice touch. There's also a very distinct feel in terms of the way it's rendered. If you watch it closely, especially early on, the skin textures are rendered and textured as though they're part of the pulp pages. So if you go back to the old pulp novels and pulp stories where a lot of these gumshoes began, there is a certain tone and feel to the paper, and they've rendered that on the skins to the point that when the characters are talking, you know, at first glance it might look like 2D. These are CGI animations, and as the mouths move, it's like the paper pulls and the texture goes with it. And early on, it threw me out a little bit, because when he speaks in the first couple of scenes, the bottom of his chin doesn't move. It's just the mouth, again, floating on an otherwise static skull. Although that does get corrected and changed as it goes on, and the textures actually get smoothed out a bit, which makes me wonder if it's only X amount of time on the rendering farm, which way do we go? Do we have the fully animated mouth, or do we have that pulp paper texture? And I think they went with the fully animated mouth, but cut down the texture as sort of that cost savings.
Yeah, that makes sense, really, because all these things are fairly short, and they are working on the timetable of, you got to finish this before the second movie comes out.
Yeah, this was greenlit fairly late in the project.
Although it's not the one that's the latest in the project. The one that's latest is the very last film in the piece, and I think the weak point.
Yeah, the Matriculated. Now, to this point, Alex has been talking about the big names in anime and the ones that are the most famous. This was the one written and directed by the only guy aside from the Wachowskis that I knew about coming in, and that's Peter Chung. A lot of us in North America would know him as the creator of Rugrats and Aeon Flux. And he's got a very distinct style. You can see the faces and hands, and these character designs are absolutely Peter Chung. He does tone down on the tongues a bit. If you go back and watch Rugrats and Aeon Flux, those tongues are everywhere. It's probably the most active muscle in any of their bodies. Although in his later works like this, and then the animated Rinnick film, they are fairly calm. It's also the longest one in this set. Most of them are about 9 minutes, whereas this one was closer to 16. It does tie in a little bit. I found there's a lot of abstract art. Some of the rendering of the faces when they're in the CGI environment and the other elements seem to have maybe a bit of a Norman McLaren influence to them, particularly going back to his work in Neighbors from the 1960s, which was, you know, McLaren's send-up of the Korean War. It was decent, but I think the length hurt it. If you look at the amount of story we have here and what's being established, there's a lot of seemingly ineffectual events. It's a very slow pace. This certainly didn't need to be significantly longer than the rest. They could have streamlined it and kept them all in line and consistent. I'm not entirely sure where they made that choice. Because I found it was an interesting concept of, you know, basically a group who are lying to the machines as a way of reprogramming them to get machines on their side, to use some machines to fight others. I don't know how effectively that would work because we know how heavily networked these machines are, whether it be like IQ or they'd spread out or whether they'd be overtaken and corrected. But it is an interesting idea to play with. Now, for all we know, they've got the technology that breaks them off the network at the same time so that we don't have that issue. But to me, we had the piece, which is one of the weaker ones, in spite of the fact that it actually does tell a complete story while we're at it. I just found it didn't grab me. There was a nice concept, but the execution didn't pull me in to follow up on that.
Agreed. The one bit I kind of liked, but it went on too long, was the bits with the machine in the artificial reality. I thought it was an interesting touch, because normally when people think of sort of biotechnological horror, they think of the works of like H.R. Giger or that sort of thing where the focus, while it's theoretically technological, the focus of the art style is on the organic elements. This wall looks like a spinal column kind of thing. Or this door looks like a bodily orifice. Whereas with his artificial reality, which kind of freaks out the machine when it first goes in, it kind of puts everything in the opposite perspective in the sense that the bits which in the human sort of work, human works would focus on the organic, instead focus on the mechanical and the repetitive and systematic. Repeating colors and motifs and geometric patterns and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And even the human characters in there, in that simulated reality, are re-rendered. So it's similar styling, especially the female lead is like to me, struck me as similar in style to Maria from the 1927 live-action Metropolis by Fritz Lang. A lot of people wouldn't think Maria was the inspiration for the design of C-3PO, and that's where a lot of people would engage first, just because of the familiarity with that. But, yeah, even the humans, when they're trying to win him over, they were rendering themselves as though they were artificial intelligence and robots in this world, while the ship had a similar feel to the organic ship from Farscape in terms of the shape of the corridors and the way they lay out.
Yeah. The problem with the sequence, though, is because of the length of the piece, they spend probably half the runtime of 16 minutes, 8 minutes or so or more in there. And it eventually it kind of gets old.
It does. I think in this 60-minute runtime, you could probably go back and find 6 or 7 minutes that could easily be cut.
And there are some interesting narrative bits there. There's particularly a bit towards the beginning where they're talking about, where the humans are talking about the project, and they're kind of comparing with what they're doing to the machines to what the machines are doing to humans. And it's interesting sort of philosophical discussion, and I almost wish they'd done more with that, that they dismiss it so quickly.
Yeah, this is great for opening doors that have a lot of potential. It just doesn't go through any of them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah, that's the big thing. There's so much potential here. There's a lot of potential. And with the added running time, you'd think they'd do something with that potential, but they don't. Even the ending where the machine, which has appeared to actually change its sides and sympathize with the humans, after all the humans are dead, it tries to jack back in with the female lead, whose name I don't remember, and then she just kind of kills herself for some reason. It's not clear. She just screams, and then apparently she's dead, and we don't know. There's no explanation.
Yeah, it does have a very abstract art feel, which, as I said, to me feels a lot like Norman McLaren. But with Norman McLaren, at least you could see where he's going with it.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that from the documentary features and stuff, that basically Peter Chung was basically brought in on this project at the last minute. And this is a piece that he wrote himself. It's not like he's operating off of something that the Wachowskis wrote, which is also kind of unfortunate because, to a certain degree, if time is limited, if you're working off of something else, like pre-existing work, that can kind of make up for the lack of time. You can go, okay, I don't have to spend as much time on this because this is already done or mostly done. I can adapt. I can expand on this slightly and create my own elements with other stuff. Apparently, the person who the Wachowskis originally had in mind for this spot dropped out partway through, and I kind of wish or wonder if that person had, if the Wachowskis had their own script already and this guy was going to work off that. If Peter Chung had been worked off that script with the Wachowskis, maybe things might have turned out better. But instead, it's kind of a combination of too little time and too much time. Too much time in the film and too little time to put the work together. Particularly to get the animation done in a timely manner for the 16 minutes that's available.
To me, I almost wonder if one of the goals of this was to hit a particular runtime of that 89-minute mark. Because if we didn't have these 16 minutes, that leaves us a 73-minute run. And one of the things we've seen in Warner Brothers animation direct-to-video, they try to aim their kids' fare in that 75 to 89-minute range. They don't like to go over 90, and they don't like to go below 75. So I wonder if Peter Chung had something in mind, said he wanted to pitch this, and they said, okay, this is your time constraint. I'd almost wonder if he was aiming for something a little bit longer and decided to scrap story elements just to keep the visuals. It feels off. It feels like they were telling the wrong part of a piece, and either they edited the story to focus on the visuals, or they just said, well, these visuals look amazing, let's just do more of them, and they kept rendering.
Yeah. And I know that when Peter Chung was brought in, it was at the Wachowskis' request, where the other guy dropped out, and Wachowskis basically said, hey, we like Aeon Flux, let's get Peter Chung. And so, I don't know how much of this is he had an idea that he wanted to do when he was brought in, or the situation where he came in, or is brought in and said, hey, Wachowski said, hey, do something, it needs to be done by this day, and we have 16 minutes for you because this, we planned this to be the climax, and so we want to give it more time. Something like that. Because that's my theory for how this came about in terms of runtime and combination of runtime and position in the film and all that sort of stuff. And it's an interesting note, aside from everything else, it's an interesting note to go down on. I mean, most of the pieces kind of go out on something of a downer note, but this piece has a different downer note than the other ones. For Final Fight of the Osiris, it's downer because everyone's dead, but there's a slight hint of hope in that the message drop was successful. Second Renaissance is a downer in that the machines run, but hey, there's still some humanity in Zion. Although the level of the downer may overwhelm that. Kid's story is kind of a higher note because the kid gets out. He ultimately kind of wins.
Even in World Record, it feels like a downer to us who know he's in the Matrix, but it really does feel like the character got what he wanted. He got his world record. He came out of it in one piece. When they're saying, well, he'll never walk again. Well, he does get up and take a few steps, which at that stage, it gives hope he's going to have a happy ending. Detective Story, it's ambiguous enough. You can choose to believe the ending you choose to believe. Beyond is nice. They have their fun day, but everyone makes out of it okay. This, had it been up to me, I would have opened on Second Renaissance, which doesn't have quite the same stylistic match to the film as The Final Flight of the Osiris, but it goes in with Zion and enough of the backstory and introduces it. It's sort of about how we got to this point stage that if you were someone who was watching the Animatrix, not having seen the Matrix, that could get you up to speed and get you going so that the rest would make sense. If you're coming in blind, I don't know that Final Flight of the Osiris is the right starting point. It really was edited and arranged for those who are coming in having seen The Matrix only. Now, had you taken Final Fight of the Osiris and ended on that, not only was it segging directly into the next movie, as you said, but you get a much bigger punch. Even though it's pretty short on story, it's high on style, it leads you right back into The Matrix, and it is engaging just because the action sequences we see are that well executed.
Yeah. In fact, actually, for a discussion of how to organize it, it reminds me a bit of another anime sort of anthology film that came out more recently, the last one of this type in a while, Halo Legends. Halo Legends starts out with basically their version of the Second Renaissance, which is the fall of the Forerunners and the rise of the Flood, and the construction of the Halo Project. And then from there, it goes into various stories, expanding on the mythology, talking about the Spartan Project, and all that sort of stuff, ending in a high note with a big rescue mission. And which doesn't exactly lead directly into Halo 4, but it sets up some characters for future Halo games. And I think the way that you described how the film should be organized really would have worked better. Because Final Fight of Osiris is the right point to end on. It's the right point to set up the next two movies, to get you pumped for the next two movies, in terms of giving you some good old-fashioned Matrix-style action, Matrix action, as well as setting up, okay, here's the threat for the next two movies. The one other complaint I have, and actually relates to how the Matrix franchise is organized more than this, is that the next act of this, retrieving the message, isn't told in the movies. It's told in the horrible, horrible Enter the Matrix video game. In a level, not a cutscene, which means that it's, that if you want to experience that portion of the story, you can't even watch it on the Here's the Cutscenes from Enter the Matrix feature on the Matrix Trilogy set, Matrix Anthology Collection. You have to actually play the game, and you should never play that game.
Yeah, which is sad, because if ever there was a franchise that was well set up to have a very good game, it's this one.
And to be fair, it did get a good game. It got the Matrix Path of Neo, which came after the series was done and was meant almost as much of a sort of gamified retelling of the Matrix story rather than expanding on the universe, which is what Enter the Matrix was supposed to do. And which kind of failed at.
Yeah, it could well be. Anyway, taking the film as a whole and looking at it in terms of in the greatest science fiction film tournament that it's a part of, I would say it is interesting to watch. If you are an existing fan of The Matrix and its franchise, it is worth checking out because it does raise interesting questions. It does give you some nice facets of the universe. If you have no interest in The Matrix, I would say leave it alone. If you do watch it, watch in the order we recommended, or at the very least start with chapters 2 and 3 before you go to the play all option. Because if you start on Final Flight of the Osiris, odds are very good you're going to be lost.
Absolutely. I definitely see this is perfect for fans of the Matrix franchise. I'd also say this is excellent for if you kind of like the Matrix and you're a fan of quality animation, this is definitely worth checking out just on a sheer animation front, through how not just how things are animated, but how the various creators use animation in combination with the world of the Matrix and the layers of perceptions of reality of the Matrix to lead to some very, very interesting stylistic work.
It could also serve, I think, as a good entry point if you're looking to get into anime. Because as we said, there's a huge amount out there. And here you've got a pretty good spread of the different styles and the different techniques with all the creators credited right there on the packages. So you can watch this if you're familiar with The Matrix and see, okay, I like the direction this short was going, and track down more work by that individual.
Agreed. The only potential obstacle for getting into anime through The Animatrix is the fact that with the exception of, like, Beyond, and to a certain degree, World Record, everything here is kind of heavy, everything here is kind of intense, and there's a lot of really good, enjoyable, light fare in anime. There's a comedy, and that doesn't have any really sort of intense, bizarre elements to it. If you prefer your anime kind of silly, kind of funny, there isn't much here, or if you think you would prefer something that's like that, or if that's what would hook you into anime, there's nothing here for you, really, except for maybe Beyond. And I kind of understand why, from what I gather, the parts of anime and the styles of anime that Wachowskis like are more intense, are more thought-provoking, are darker.
Yeah, if we had something light and frivolous in here, it wouldn't belong in the Matrix world.
Yeah, and that's kind of the other side of this is, to make the animation that fits in the world of the Matrix, you have to be kind of dark. And the minus side, if the type of animation that you prefer is something that isn't dark, then there isn't anything here for you, which is unfortunate, but I understand the reason why.
Yeah, so in terms of the standings, this made it through round one. For those that are following these through podcasts and weren't familiar with the tournament, round one was where our readers ranked 384 films as above average, average, below average, or not interested. We then took the top 120 contenders from that, plus 8 wild cards. And in round 2, we began the actual elimination tournament. This made it through round 1 and was eliminated in round 2 when it went head-to-head with Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And I would say that is a fair elimination, coming in with a fair amount of familiarity with Kubrick's work and with Dr. Strangelove.
Agreed. I mean, I enjoy The Animatrix, but Dr. Strangelove deserves to win this. It's one of the classics of speculative fiction and just cinema in general. It's kind of like going up, I mean, it's basically got put up against a juggernaut. To put it in somewhat pro wrestling terms. Animatrix is the Brooklyn Brawler, and Dr. Strangelove is Hulk Hogan. Sorry, Hogan wins.
I would say I'm not a wrestling fan, and Hulk Hogan is the one of those two I've heard of.
Yeah. Brooklyn Brawler is the one, is the wrestler who's known for a loss record that is astronomical. Like, truly astronomical. He's what's known in wrestling terms as a jobber. Because he loses. It's his job to lose.
Okay.
So, I'm glad it made it in. I do hope that through the tournament, more people check this out. And I hope that some of you check it out and do enjoy it. However, there's plenty more anime in the tournament, and some of which is still, I think, in the running. And we'll see how well they do.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. For those listening later, this is being recorded early in round 3. We're currently in the second week of round 3, which is a 4-week round. So the next few weeks are going to get pretty heated as the decisions get harder and harder and harder. But that's a lot of the fun. So keep listening. We don't have firm schedules for when these come out because our Greatest Science Fiction Film Tournament podcasts will always be two voice podcasts. So we do need to track down a couple people who have a chance to review it and watch it carefully before we do the podcast. And they will all come out through the Bureau 42 Master Audio Feed podcast, along with our currently regular Silver Screen Superman podcast that come out on the 14th of the month, every month this year. Into Batman next year, and most likely just general superhero films the year after that, and ongoing. And we are going to have a bi-weekly X-Files series starting to celebrate the 20th anniversary of that on September 10th of this year. And we have a few other projects that are kind of boiling in on the burner, but we don't want to announce those until we know for sure we can hit and maintain the schedule as they're being announced. So keep your ears open for those as well. And Alex, thanks for joining us for this one.
I'm glad to be here.
Okay, and this is Blaine and Alex signing off.